You're listening to The Andy Finn Show, centrally located in America, on the TAFS Radio Network.
The Andy Finn Show is back, and I'm here with Concetta Stewart, the Dean of the College of Communication at Temple University, and a woman who's a leader, and is here with me talking about leadership. So, Concetta, the next piece of advice we got in this list of 12 of life's lessons for leadership is from Stacy Schneider. She's the chairman of Universal Pictures. And what Schneider recommends is that how you deal with the tough times in life defines your character and who you are. Her father taught her that adversity breeds character. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are when you hear that.
Couldn't be truer words spoken. By the way, not to plug somebody else's media product, but I am reading a gift, a book that was given to me, Elizabeth I, CEO.
And I just saw that review of that book.
Excellent book. And that's one of the key takeaways I have from the book. She certainly had her share of adversity, like none I could imagine, certainly. But I think tough times test you on a lot of levels. First of all, can you really operate with integrity and dignity?
Yes.
That's really put to the test. How flexible you can be, how quick you can be on your feet, how you can deal with cards others have dealt you. And in some cases, it can be relentless. And that really is a test of a leader, because that is, as to use the cliche, what you get paid the big bucks for, and that's what your people look for you to be able to lead them through. And I will tell you, the first few times you go through something that's really, really trying, you just think, what did I sign up for? But it does get easier, and you begin to realize that that's the measure of a true leader.
Are you saying you run into the same problems, like you were explaining before, someone you have to have the conversation with about not getting tenure? Or are you saying that when somebody, after you've dealt with a few curveballs, there are different curveballs coming, you don't know exactly what they will look like, but you know that it's a curveball?
Yes, and you know that you can handle them.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are different, maybe categories of tough times, certainly, and you start to begin to recognize them. That's the other thing, too. The more you go through, the more you recognize before they get too bad or too far out of hand.
This is a category 3 storm.
exactly.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
But you also learn, it's a funny thing, this crazy expression we have in the English language, I don't know about others, but something went wrong. As though right is the normal course of events. I think we need to understand that things aren't going to always go as planned and be prepared for that. And I think that's the hardest thing we have. We are just so oriented toward things going along a certain path. And when we get these curveballs, I think we're really thrown into more of a tizzy than I think we really should be.
Well, and I think what you're saying, the old expression is change is inevitable, except from a vending machine.
Right.
And so, but the principle there is that you need to plan for change, and that's hard to do because while the saying is be flexible, in general, you'd like to see life continue the way it has, whether it's the number of students that register for your courses, or it's the amount of revenue you bring in for your products, or whatever it is, you'd like to think the past is going to be like the future. But, of course, change is going to jump up and bite you.
And that's really what a leader needs to be able to see coming.
Well, let me ask you this. The thing that I questioned or thought of when I heard this expression, how you deal with the tough times defines your character and who you are, it struck me that maybe it tests your character or challenges your character, but it strikes me that you will have the character you have developed up to that point. And if there's a weakness in it, it gets exposed when the going gets rough. And what I mean by that is this, I guess, Concetta, when let's take a leader who's not as secure as a leader might be. When something goes wrong, they may panic. They may blame others. They may do several things. And over time, the next time, they may learn from that event. But this idea that the tough times defines the character, the other thing she said was her father taught her that adversity breeds character. I could see where next time out it breeds character. But this time, you got the character you have, and it gets exposed under pressure. Does that make sense?
Unfortunately, I happen to agree with you in that it tends to bring out the worst in people.
Yeah, because under pressure, you retreat to what you know works, and sometimes that's bullying or it's whatever.
It's what you're comfortable with.
Yeah, exactly. And so a poor leader retreats to poor strategies.
And that's, I think it's interesting. In tough times, very often the response is to do nothing at all and hope it goes away. And that's certainly not something a leader has the luxury of doing. And because it's usually a situation that you're not familiar with, you don't have the toolkit. So I think you're going to fall back on whatever's most comfortable. And sometimes it's...
And this does not seem like the time when most people will do what we were talking about before, which is admitting mistakes.
Right.
Because in uncertainty, you're kind of up against the wall and you're, kind of in fight or flight reflex. And you're like, whatever you do, don't let them see you sweat.
Right, exactly.
But right. I assume as you get more comfortable with those situations, A, you're just more comfortable...
Oh, absolutely.
With uncertainty, but you can break the ice somehow or break the tension with either, whether it's humor or an admission that, hey, I'm not sure exactly what we ought to do, but here's what we're going to try.
And doing it sooner than later. And that's the other thing that a leader is able to do, is to just get in there very early on in the situation and try to turn it around rather than let things evolve to a point where it's going to be more difficult to fix them.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense. And, of course, if we look at the failures, whether it's in the corporate world, and I'm not going to list any of them right now, or it's in the political world, which we could go through several just in the last couple administrations, it's very clear that we almost always see leaders wait too long to address things. And everybody else is aware it should be addressed, and the leader holds off.
And you lose a lot of respect in that process.
Well, you lose time to fix the problem. Yeah, there's a bunch of things you lose. Well, let me move on to another piece of advice that Stacy Schneider gave here. And that was, this is my paraphrase of what she said, overcome the youthful urge to be ego-driven and give up your immature behaviors as early as you can in your career.
You know, I also have to say how embarrassed I am that I can identify with that one as well.
Oh, I think we all can. But go ahead. Tell us a juicy little tidbit.
No, but what's interesting is when you take over a large organization, it goes to your head. It's hard not to, particularly if you're young and if it happens quickly, you begin to think you're special. And in some ways you are, but you're not that special. Get over it and get the job done. Because I think the more one focuses on the uniqueness that they bring to the job and not on the job that's got to get done, they're going to lose sight of what's important. And it's not about you, it's about what you do. And that's why when you keep it focused on what the outcomes are and what you're trying to achieve, it's very easy to shed any of that egomania. But it's hard not to... You know, when you have so many people who want to spend time with you or praising you, fawning all over, it can go to your head if you're not careful. But then you got to get over it and say, okay, what is it I'm trying to do today?
Well, that makes perfect sense to me. And I have to say that I have known you a long time. I've seen you at different levels of leadership. I've not really been close to you as in your current role as dean or as department head at Temple. But by the time I met you, you were quite mature, certainly for your age. And so I never saw you as ego-driven, although at some level we all are. I'm now aware I was much more ego-driven when you and I first met than you were. And I do think that you have a good perspective on a lot of these things, although when we talk about immature behaviors, it's all relative. There are always things that we can give up. I can look at things I learned in my 40s that, as you say, you know, I'm embarrassed to say, but I didn't realize how I was about X, Y, or Z just a few years ago.
But it's difficult to acknowledge with these kinds of failings that, you know, you are focused on really superficial aspects of your performance. And so I have to say that the most important thing a leader can do is to really move away from the fact of having people sucking up to them. I don't know how else to put it, and really just say, what is it that I'm trying to do here, and have I been effective in getting it done?
Well, and I do think that's how leaders get isolated. You know, we hear the talk of yes men, right? Leaders who are surrounded by people that say, yes, sir, a wonderful idea, sir, as opposed to saying, you might want to reconsider that. Have you thought about X, Y, Z? And of course, the higher people reach, the more likely you are to have yes men around you or yes women, unless you make it a point to follow the advice we heard earlier, which is surround yourself with good people.
And let them know that you are willing to hear what they have to say, even if it's unpleasant.
That's right. You have to be open to that. Yep. And we have, I've talked just recently with a couple of friends about the fact that part of this whole situation with the Bush administration, this current stuff they're going through, comes from the idea that the people, whether or not Bush wants to hear bad stuff, the people around him seem to think that he doesn't. And, you know, a president always lives in a bubble, but there's a bubble where you're not allowed to carry cash, or you don't need cash, and you aren't allowed to stop in a store and buy a book because it causes too much commotion. And there's a bubble where people aren't telling you straight out what they think. And anybody can be caught in that kind of bubble, any leader.
Yeah, and it's not because you think you're so smart. It's because you don't have time. You're saying, I've got to get this done. I don't have time to deal with this divergence of opinion. I just need to keep moving forward.
Also, it seems to me there's a deference. At some level, people say, oh, well, this person knows what direction they're going. You know, the more decisive someone appears, the more in command you appear, they say, well, they don't want to hear about this.
You know, and that's something I'm going to slip off the rails of what I said earlier, how I don't think that men and women are all that different. I think in this one area, I think women have a little bit of an edge, and that is watching the nonverbal. When I'm in a meeting, I watch for the person who's not speaking up, particularly if it's someone who isn't always quiet, and I look to see if there's something that they don't feel they can say. And I will try to draw it out of them.
Will you draw it out there, or might it be someone you need to talk to separately later?
It could be either. But I watch. I really do watch people's nonverbal reactions to what's being said.
Well, and part of that is, of course, you're, as a communication scholar, as someone with a PhD in communication, you're going to be tuned to nonverbals, although I think what you're saying is, given a male and a female communication scholar, the male may or may not attend to nonverbal signals in the room.
Right. I mean, it's one thing to study and know the theory of nonverbal communication. It's quite another to be able to recognize it. And I think that's something that I've prided myself in, and I think it's also a way to help you in negotiations or in trying not to be diplomatic and not insult people, save face, that type of thing.
No, I think you're absolutely right. There's constant feedback coming in any situation with one person or with a group in a meeting. There's constant feedback coming from people as you speak. And most of us adjust at some level, but a lot of us go blithely along with our point or our claim or our argument when, in fact, we may have lost the listening of the people in the room, or there can be people literally shaking their heads in the room. And rather than stop and try and win them over or bring them back on board, we will just continue with the argument, thinking, well, if I press hard enough, they'll get it.
Well, you know, and unless our audience think that I'm very narrow-minded here, we have to recognize that this is really American communication styles we're talking about. Certainly nonverbal communication is certainly more integral parts of other cultures. And so I don't want to pretend that American women have a corner on it, because it's certainly in other cultures, both men and women attend to nonverbal communication far more carefully than we do.
Right. And, in fact, you move into intercultural situations where you're working in a corporation that's dealing overseas, and the nonverbals may be the most important signals, because the other person may not speak English as fluently as they would like or as you do. And so there's any number of situations that come up where it's important to really get a read on people, whatever that means.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, when we come back, we're going to move on to the last couple of goals here that were recommended by the women who were providing life lessons for leaders.